The hammer fell against red-hot steel for the thousandth time that shift, sending sparks cascading across my scarred forearms. My name was Marcus Thorne, though that meant nothing in this place. Here, I was prisoner designation 7742 Alpha, another broken soul feeding the Imperial War machine's endless hunger for weapons. The Manufactorum's heat pressed against me like a living thing, turning every breath into a struggle against superheated air that tasted of metal shavings and desperation. Sweat dripped from my brow onto the lasgun power pack casing I was shaping, hissing away instantly on contact with the molten metal. Around me, hundreds of other convicts labored in similar torment, their hammers creating a rhythmic cacophony that had become the soundtrack to my damnation. The forge stretched endlessly in both directions, a cathedral of suffering built to glorify the Emperor through the production of instruments of death. I had been a Cadian shock trooper once, the 47th Shock Regiment, 3rd Company, 2nd Platoon. We had held the line on Zirian Prime when the Greenskin Tide came screaming out of the ash wastes. My squad had been positioned on the eastern flank, tasked with holding a supply depot that contained enough ammunition to keep an entire regiment fighting for months. The orcs had come at dawn, their crude artillery pieces lobbing shells with terrifying accuracy into our hastily constructed positions. The memory burned worse than the forge's heat. Sergeant Kellick had been shouting orders when the first shell landed directly in our trench. The explosion had turned him into a red mist, along with half my squad mates. Private Heron had been screaming, his legs gone from the knees down, begging someone to help him. The second shell had landed close enough to shower us all with debris and the pulverized remains of our comrades. That was when I ran, not immediately. I had tried to drag Heron to safety first, but when the third shell whistled overhead, something inside me broke completely. I dropped him and sprinted toward the rear lines, abandoning my post and my duty in one cowardly moment that would define the rest of my miserable existence. The commissar had found me 3 hours later, cowering behind a supply crate while the rest of my regiment died trying to hold positions I should have been defending. The court-martial had been swift. Desertion in the face of the enemy carried only one sentence, but my previous service record had earned me a stay of execution. Instead, I was stripped of rank, branded a coward, and sentenced to penal servitude on Korath's world, a prison planet dedicated to manufacturing weapons for the very regiments I had abandoned. A servo skull drifted past my workstation, its red optical sensor scanning for signs of slacking or sabotage. The mechanical device hovered silently, recording everything with cold efficiency before moving on to terrorize the next prisoner. These floating surveillance units were everywhere, ensuring that even a moment's rest would be immediately reported to the overseers. The Adeptus Arbites guards who patrolled the forge floor carried shock mauls crackling with electrical energy. They wore full carapace armor despite the oppressive heat, their faces hidden behind reflective visors that made them appear more machine than human. One of them walked past my station now, the heavy footfalls of his combat boots barely audible over the constant hammering. His shock maul hung casually from his belt, a reminder that any infraction would result in immediate and brutal punishment. Warden Militant Korath ruled this place with absolute authority. I had only seen him twice since my arrival 6 months ago, but his presence permeated every aspect of life in the Manufactorum. He was a former Imperial Guard Colonel who had been granted governorship of this facility as a reward for distinguished service. The man took perverse pleasure in breaking those who had failed the Emperor, viewing us not as criminals to be reformed, but as raw materials to be consumed in service to the Imperium. The hierarchy among prisoners was complex and constantly shifting. Former guardsmen like myself held a tenuous position of authority over the gangers, heretics, and common criminals who made up the majority of the population. We understood military discipline and weapon construction, making us valuable enough to avoid the worst assignments. The gang members from various hive worlds formed their own power structures, while the religious dissidents and minor heretics occupied the bottom rung of the social order. Despite our differences, we were all united in our hatred of Korath and his enforcers. The man had instituted a system of collective punishment that ensured any individual transgression would result in suffering for entire work groups. This created an atmosphere of paranoid surveillance where prisoners watched each other as carefully as the servo skulls did, knowing that someone else's moment of weakness could result in their own agony. My current assignment involved forging power pack casings for standard issue las guns. The work required precision despite the primitive tools we were given. Each casing had to meet exact specifications or the entire batch would be rejected, resulting in reduced food rations for everyone in the work detail. I had learned to gauge the metal's temperature by color alone, knowing exactly when to strike and when to let it cool. My hands bore the scars of countless burns from the early days when I had not yet adapted to this hellish routine. The convict working beside me was a former ganger from Necromunda named Vex. His arms were covered in crude tattoos depicting various gang symbols and kill marks. He had been sentenced for participating in a rebellion against the planetary governor's tithe collectors. Unlike many of the other prisoners, Vex had adapted quickly to the Forge's demands, his natural aggression channeled into productive labor. He hammered at his own power pack casing with methodical intensity, occasionally glancing at the patrolling guards with barely concealed hatred. Across the aisle, a group of heretics worked on bayonet production. These men had been caught practicing forbidden rituals in the underhive of some distant world. Their leader was a gaunt man named Thaddeus, who claimed to have been a minor clerk in the Administratum before his fall from grace. He maintained that his crimes had been merely theological in nature, but the brand on his forehead marked him as someone who had trafficked with forces beyond imperial orthodoxy. The work shifts lasted 18 hours with only brief breaks for nutrient paste and water. Sleep came in cramped dormitories where hundreds of prisoners were packed into spaces designed for half that number. The constant exhaustion made everything feel dreamlike and surreal, as if the entire experience was some prolonged nightmare from which I might eventually wake. But this was no dream. Every morning brought the same routine of brutal labor under the watchful eyes of our captors. The servo skulls never tired, the guards never showed mercy, and the quotas never decreased. We were expected to produce a specific number of weapons components each day, and failure to meet those targets resulted in punishment that ranged from reduced rations to public floggings. I had witnessed three prisoners die during my time here. The first had collapsed from heat exhaustion during his second week, his body unable to adapt to the Forge's demands. The guards had left his corpse where it fell until the end of the shift, forcing us to work around the cooling body as a reminder of our own mortality. The second death had been more dramatic. A former PDF trooper had attempted to attack a guard with his hammer and been shot down immediately. The third had simply given up, refusing to work until the repeated beatings finally stopped his heart. Each death reinforced the same lesson. Resistance was futile, escape was impossible, and our only hope of survival lay in absolute compliance with the system that had consumed us. Yet despite this knowledge, I could feel something building within the prisoner population. The daily humiliations and casual brutality were creating a pressure that would eventually find release, regardless of the consequences. The Manufactorum operated around the clock, with different shifts rotating through the same workstations. The night shift was considered the worst assignment, as the reduced lighting and skeleton crew of guards created opportunities for violence between prisoners. I had been fortunate enough to remain on day shift since my arrival, though I knew that could change at any moment based on the arbitrary whims of our overseers. My hammer continued its steady rhythm against the cooling metal, each blow bringing the power pack casing closer to completion. Around me, the endless symphony of industrial labor continued, punctuated by the occasional bark of orders from the guards or the mechanical whir of servo skulls adjusting their surveillance patterns. This was my existence now, measured not in days or weeks, but in the number of weapons components I could produce before my body finally gave out. The scars on my hands told the story of my adaptation to this place. Fresh burns layered over older injuries, creating a map of suffering that extended from my fingertips to my shoulders. Every prisoner bore similar marks, badges of survival in a system designed to consume human lives as readily as it consumed raw materials. The heat had grown worse over the past 3 days, if such a thing was even possible. The Manufactorum's cooling systems had begun failing during the previous week, and the tech adepts responsible for maintenance seemed either unwilling or unable to address the problem. Temperatures that had once been merely unbearable now approached levels that made simple breathing feel like drowning in molten air. The metal surfaces we worked with had become so hot that even brief contact left blistering burns. Yet we were expected to maintain the same production quotas regardless of conditions. I watched prisoner 9847 Beta collapse at his workstation for the second time that morning. The man had been a hive ganger before his conviction, his body already weakened by years of chemical abuse and malnutrition. Now the forge's heat was finishing what the underhive had started. Two servitors approached his unconscious form with their usual mechanical indifference, grasping his arms with articulated claws and dragging him toward the rear of the manufactorum. None of us knew exactly what happened to prisoners who were taken away like this, but they never returned to their stations. The water rations had been cut again yesterday. What had once been a meager allowance was now reduced to a few sips of recycled liquid that tasted of rust and chemical purification agents. The reduction was supposedly temporary, according to the announcement delivered by Servo Skull, but temporary measures in this place had a way of becoming permanent fixtures of our suffering. My throat felt like sandpaper, and every swallow sent sharp pain through my parched tissues. Vex was struggling beside me, his tattooed arms shaking as he lifted his hammer. The Necromunda ganger had always been one of the stronger prisoners, but even his enhanced physiology was beginning to fail under these conditions. Sweat no longer flowed from his body, a dangerous sign that indicated severe dehydration. His skin had taken on a grayish pallor that reminded me of corpses I had seen on various battlefields. Three more prisoners had collapsed since the morning shift began. Each time, the same servitors appeared to drag them away while the rest of us continued working. The guards seemed unconcerned by the increasing casualty rate, their attention focused instead on maintaining production schedules. One Arbites enforcer walked past a collapsed prisoner without even glancing down, his shock maul crackling with electrical energy as he scanned for signs of deliberate work stoppage. The young man working two stations down from me was named Keller, though I only knew this because he had mentioned it during one of our brief meal periods. He had been convicted of desertion from a planetary defense force on some agri world whose name I had already forgot. The kid could not have been more than 19 standard years, his face still bearing traces of the softness that marked those who had never truly known hardship before their imprisonment. Keller's movements had become increasingly erratic over the past hour. His hammer strikes were missing their targets, sending sparks flying in dangerous directions that drew angry glares from nearby prisoners. The power pack casing he was supposed to be shaping remained barely begun, its metal surface showing only the faintest impressions where it should have displayed precise geometric patterns. I could see the panic growing in his eyes as he realized his inability to complete the work would result in punishment for our entire section. The servo skull monitoring our area had begun hovering closer to Keller's station, its red optical sensors recording every failed hammer strike. These mechanical observers possessed sophisticated analysis capabilities that could detect even minor deviations from expected productivity levels. Once they identified a problem worker, intervention by the guards typically followed within minutes. Keller suddenly stopped working entirely, his hammer falling from nerveless fingers to clatter against the stone floor. He swayed on his feet for a moment before pitching forward onto his workbench, his face striking the hot metal with a sound like meat hitting a grill. The smell of burning flesh filled the air around his station, but he made no attempt to pull away from the surface that was searing his cheek. I moved toward him instinctively, though I knew such action violated the strict prohibition against leaving our assigned positions. Keller's eyes had rolled back in his head, showing only white, and his breathing had become shallow and irregular. The dehydration had finally overwhelmed his young body's ability to function, and I could see death approaching with the same certainty I had once recognized on distant battlefields. The servitors were already approaching when Keller's breathing stopped entirely. His body gave one final convulsive shudder before going completely still, his face still pressed against the metal that continued burning his flesh even in death. The mechanical constructs grasped his arms and began dragging him away, leaving a trail of blood and burned skin across the manufactorum floor. Something snapped in the prisoner population at that moment. The sight of the young man's corpse being dragged away like refuse triggered a collective rage that had been building for months. Vex was the first to act, grabbing a piece of scrap metal and hurling it at the nearest servo skull with surprising accuracy. The improvised projectile struck the mechanical observer squarely, sending it spinning out of control before crashing into a support pillar. The destruction of the servo skull seemed to signal open rebellion. Prisoners throughout our section began abandoning their workstations, grabbing hammers, metal bars, and anything else that could serve as weapons. The months of accumulated hatred and desperation erupted in a wave of violence that swept across the Manufactorum floor like wildfire spreading through dry vegetation. I found myself caught up in the momentum despite my better judgment. My military training screamed warnings about the futility of resistance, but the sight of Keller's death had awakened something primal that overrode rational thought. When Vex thrust a jagged piece of metal into my hands and gestured toward the guard station, I followed without hesitation. The first Arbites enforcer we encountered was completely unprepared for organized resistance. These guards were accustomed to dealing with individual troublemakers or small disputes, not coordinated attacks by dozens of desperate prisoners. Vex struck him across the helmet with a heavy wrench, the impact producing a satisfying crack that indicated damage to the protective equipment beneath. More prisoners joined our group as we moved through the Manufactorum, their improvised weapons gleaming in the forge's hellish light. A former Imperial Guard sergeant named Tors had taken command of another group, leading them in a flanking maneuver designed to cut off the guards' retreat routes. The man's tactical knowledge was evident in how he positioned his followers, using the Manufactorum's machinery as cover while advancing on the primary guard station. The Arbites forces were beginning to organize their response, but their heavy armor made rapid movement difficult in the extreme heat. Several guards had already fallen to prisoner attacks, their shock mauls proving inadequate against determined assaults by multiple attackers. One enforcer attempted to radio for reinforcements, but was overwhelmed before he could complete the transmission. I realized with growing horror that the other prisoners were looking to me for leadership. My former rank as a guardsman, combined with my visible participation in the initial assault, had marked me as someone capable of military command. Tors was coordinating his own group, but the larger mass of rebelling prisoners seemed to expect direction from me. The weight of their expectations felt heavier than any weapon I had ever carried. The main guard station was a fortified position built into the Manufactorum structure, its reinforced walls designed to withstand exactly this type of assault. However, the guards inside had not anticipated that prisoners would gain access to industrial cutting tools. Several convicts were already working to breach the station's outer defenses using plasma torches and metal cutting equipment salvaged from their workstations. Our improvised assault was succeeding beyond all reasonable expectations, but I knew this victory would be temporary. The Manufactorum's communication systems would eventually summon reinforcements from other sections of the facility, and those forces would be better prepared for organized resistance. We had perhaps minutes before overwhelming retaliation would crush our rebellion with brutal efficiency. The sound of approaching boots echoed through the Manufactorum's corridors, their rhythm indicating disciplined troops moving in formation. The reinforcements had arrived faster than I had anticipated, suggesting that contingency plans for prisoner uprisings were already in place. These would not be the regular guards we had been fighting, but specialized riot suppression forces equipped with heavier weapons and armor. The first wave of Arbites reinforcements entered through the Manufactorum's main access points, their riot shields forming an impenetrable wall that advanced steadily toward our positions. Behind the shields, I could see the distinctive helmets and carapace armor of veteran enforcers, their equipment significantly more sophisticated than what the regular guards carried. These men moved with the confidence of troops who had suppressed countless similar uprisings. The shock mauls they wielded were larger and more powerful than the standard equipment, their electrical discharges capable of stunning multiple targets simultaneously. Several prisoners who attempted to rush the shield wall were struck down immediately, their bodies convulsing as massive electrical charges coursed through their nervous systems. The smell of burned flesh and ozone filled the air as more rebels fell to the specialized weapons. Vex attempted to rally our group for a final charge against the advancing enforcers, but the futility of resistance had become obvious to everyone present. The Arbites forces had superior equipment, training, and tactical positioning. Our improvised weapons and desperate courage were no match for professional riot suppression techniques refined through decades of experience. The first prisoner to break ranks was one of the heretics from Thaddeus's work group. The man threw down his makeshift weapon and attempted to surrender, but the advancing enforcers showed no interest in accepting capitulation. A shock maul struck him across the skull with enough force to crack bone, the electrical discharge causing his entire body to spasm violently before he collapsed in a twitching heap. The systematic brutality of the suppression was designed to break our morale as much as our resistance. Each fallen prisoner served as an example to the others, demonstrating the futility of opposing imperial authority. The enforcers advanced methodically, their shock mauls rising and falling with practiced precision as they cleared each section of the Manufactorum. Tor's group attempted to make a fighting retreat toward the rear of the facility, but they were cut off by a second wave of reinforcements that had entered through service tunnels. The former sergeant's tactical knowledge proved useless against opponents who possessed complete intelligence about the facility's layout and had planned for every possible escape route. I watched Tor's fall to a concentrated assault by three enforcers, their shock mauls striking him simultaneously from different angles. The combined electrical discharge was powerful enough to stop his heart instantly, his body going rigid before toppling backward onto the hot metal flooring. His death marked the effective end of organized resistance as the remaining prisoners began scattering in panic. The enforcers showed no mercy to fleeing prisoners. Their orders were clearly to suppress the uprising with maximum brutality, ensuring that future rebellions would be discouraged by the memory of this day's consequences. Shock mauls cracked skulls and shattered bones with mechanical efficiency, the sounds of impact mixing with screams of pain and terror. Vex made one final desperate attempt to reach the facility's main exit, his enhanced ganger physiology allowing him to move faster than most of the other prisoners. However, his path was blocked by a pair of enforcers who had anticipated his route. The shock mauls struck him simultaneously across the chest and head, the dual electrical discharge causing his augmented muscles to tear themselves apart as they contracted beyond their design limits. The suppression lasted less than 30 minutes from beginning to end. When the violence finally ceased, dozens of prisoners lay motionless on the Manufactorum floor, their bodies bearing the distinctive burns and fractures that marked shock maul victims. The surviving rebels were herded into a group at gunpoint, their faces showing the hollow expressions of men who had glimpsed hope only to have it brutally extinguished. I found myself among the survivors, though I could not remember exactly how I had avoided the fate that claimed so many others. My body bore several minor burns from shock maul contact, but nothing that would prove fatal. The enforcers seemed to have deliberately spared certain prisoners, though their selection criteria remained unclear. The aftermath of the riot brought punishments that exceeded even our worst expectations. The surviving rebels were dragged to their workstations and forced to lie across the metal surfaces while servitors approached with crude iron restraints. These devices were designed to permanently secure prisoners to their assigned positions, making escape or further rebellion physically impossible. The restraints consisted of heavy metal bands that were bolted directly through flesh and bone into the workstation surfaces. The installation process was performed without anesthetic or medical supervision, the servitors' mechanical precision, ensuring that the bolts penetrated exactly where they would cause maximum immobilization while keeping the prisoners' hands free for continued labor. My left ankle was pierced by a bolt nearly 2 inches in diameter, the metal shaft passing completely through bone and muscle before being secured to the workstation's base. The pain was indescribable, a white-hot agony that seemed to radiate through my entire nervous system. Blood pooled around the entry wound, mixing with metal shavings and industrial lubricants on the floor beneath my station. Similar restraints were applied to my right wrist and left shoulder, each bolt placement calculated to prevent movement while maintaining the arm mobility necessary for weapon production. The servitors worked with their usual mechanical indifference, treating our bodies as simply another type of raw material to be processed according to predetermined specifications. The other survivors received identical treatment, their screams echoing through the Manufactorum as bolt after bolt was driven through flesh and bone. Some prisoners lost consciousness during the procedure, but the servitors continued their work regardless, completing the installations on unconscious bodies with the same methodical precision they applied to conscious victims. When the restraint installation was complete, we were left bolted to our workstations like components in some vast industrial machine. Movement was limited to what our chains would allow, just enough to continue hammering metal, but insufficient for any other purpose. The message was clear: we would work until our bodies gave out completely, and even death would not free us from our assigned positions. The regular work schedule resumed immediately, as if the riot and its brutal suppression had been nothing more than a minor interruption in the facility's operations. New prisoners were brought in to replace those who had died, their faces showing the same mixture of fear and defiance that I remembered from my own arrival months ago. The cycle would continue, feeding the Imperial War Machine's endless appetite for weapons and human suffering. The bolts through my ankle and wrist had begun to fester by the third day after the riot. Yellow pus leaked around the metal shafts, mixing with blood and industrial grime to create a nauseating paste that attracted swarms of flies. The pain had settled into a constant throb that made concentration nearly impossible, yet I was still expected to maintain the same production quotas as before my restraints were installed. Every hammer strike sent shockwaves through the embedded metal, causing fresh agony to radiate up my leg and arm. Sleep had become a luxury I could no longer afford. The bolts made it impossible to find any comfortable position, and the infected wounds required constant attention to prevent gangrene from setting in. I had watched two other prisoners lose limbs to infection in the weeks following their restraint installation, their blackened flesh eventually requiring amputation by the facility's crude medical servitors. The severed limbs had been carried away along with the prisoners themselves, neither returning to the manufactorum floor. During the brief rest periods between shifts, I had begun exploring the areas of the facility that remained accessible despite my restraints. The chains allowed limited movement within a roughly 10-foot radius of my workstation, enough to reach the waste disposal chutes and maintenance access points that dotted the manufactorum walls. What I discovered during these painful reconnaissance missions would haunt me far worse than any battlefield memory from my time as a guardsman. The waste disposal system led to a series of lower levels that most prisoners never saw. Following the chutes required crawling through narrow metal ducts, a process made excruciating by my restraints but still technically possible. The first time I attempted this journey, I had expected to find standard recycling facilities or perhaps simple incineration chambers. Instead, I discovered something that made the Forge's daily brutality seem almost merciful by comparison. The rendering chambers occupied an entire sublevel beneath the main manufactorum floor. Massive industrial vats filled with bubbling chemical solutions lined the walls, their contents maintained at temperatures that would instantly dissolve organic matter. Conveyor systems transported bodies from the upper levels, feeding a continuous stream of human remains into the processing equipment. The air reeked of dissolved flesh and industrial solvents, a combination that burned my nostrils and throat with every breath. Servitors operated the rendering equipment with their usual methodical approach, their mechanical limbs sorting through body parts with practiced efficiency. Arms, legs, and torsos were separated according to some predetermined classification system before being fed into different processing units. The larger bones were crushed by hydraulic presses, while softer tissues were dissolved in the chemical baths. Everything was designed to extract maximum value from the raw materials that had once been living prisoners. The iron extraction process was the most disturbing aspect of the entire operation. Human blood contains significant amounts of iron, and the facility had developed sophisticated methods for harvesting this resource from deceased prisoners. Specialized filtration systems separated the metallic content from the dissolved organic matter, concentrating it into ingots that were then transported back to the upper levels for use in weapon production. I realized with growing horror that the weapons we forged contained literal pieces of our fellow prisoners. Every Lasgun power pack, every bayonet, every piece of military equipment produced in this facility incorporated iron that had once flowed through human veins. The Imperial War Machine was not simply consuming our labor and lives, it was recycling our very bodies into instruments of death that would be used to kill other Imperial citizens on distant battlefields. The discovery explained several mysteries that had puzzled me since my arrival. The unusually high mortality rate among prisoners made perfect sense when viewed as a deliberate policy rather than unfortunate circumstance. The facility was designed to kill its workforce at a steady rate, ensuring a constant supply of raw materials for the rendering chambers. We were not simply laborers, but livestock, raised and slaughtered according to production schedules. The bodies of prisoners who died from heat exhaustion, malnutrition, or industrial accidents were all processed through the same system. Even those who succumbed to infected wounds or disease contributed their iron content to the facility's output. Death offered no escape from service to the Imperium. It merely transformed us from living tools into raw materials for weapon production. During subsequent reconnaissance missions, I mapped out the entire rendering operation and began to understand its scope. The facility processed hundreds of bodies each month, extracting enough iron to supplement the traditional ore supplies by nearly 20%. This represented a significant cost savings for the Imperial war effort, as human-derived iron required no mining operations or transportation from distant worlds. The efficiency of the system was both impressive and revolting. Nothing was wasted. Even the chemical solutions used for dissolution were recycled and purified for reuse. Bone fragments that survived the initial processing were ground into powder and used as additives in the facility's concrete production. Teeth and other calcium-rich materials were harvested for use in specialized ceramics. The human body was completely consumed by the Imperial war machine, transformed into dozens of different products that would serve the Emperor's armies across the galaxy. My military experience allowed me to recognize the strategic implications of what I had discovered. If similar facilities existed throughout the Imperium, the total contribution of human-derived materials to weapon production would be enormous. Millions of prisoners, dissidents, and other undesirables could be processed annually, their bodies providing resources that would otherwise require extensive mining and refining operations. The knowledge of our ultimate fate began to spread among the surviving prisoners through carefully whispered conversations during meal periods and shift changes. I shared my discoveries with those I trusted most, former military personnel who possessed the tactical knowledge necessary for organized resistance. The revelation that death offered no escape from the facility's exploitation added a new dimension of desperation to our situation. Tors had been replaced as the informal leader of the ex-military prisoners by a former commissar named Valdris. The man had been convicted of corruption after being caught selling ammunition to black market dealers, but his knowledge of Imperial military doctrine remained valuable. Valdris possessed the strategic thinking necessary to plan operations beyond simple riots or escape attempts. Working together, we began developing plans for a coordinated assault on the facility's critical infrastructure. The rendering chambers represented a vulnerability that could potentially be exploited, as their destruction would eliminate the economic incentives that made our imprisonment profitable. Without the ability to process bodies into useful materials, the facility would become a simple labor camp rather than an integrated resource extraction operation. The ventilation systems that carried air between the upper and lower levels provided potential routes for sabotage teams to access key locations. The chemical storage areas that supplied the rendering chambers contained materials that could be weaponized if properly combined. The power distribution networks that fed the entire facility passed through choke points that could be targeted to cause cascading failures throughout the system. My restraints limited my ability to participate directly in reconnaissance missions, but other prisoners with greater mobility began mapping out the facility's weak points. A former Cadian engineer named Korvac had identified several structural vulnerabilities that could be exploited with improvised explosives. A hive ganger called Nix possessed knowledge of chemical combinations that could create devastating incendiary devices using materials available in the facility. The planning process required extreme caution, as the facility's surveillance network remained extensive despite the damage caused during the riot. Servo Skulls continued their patrols, though their numbers had been reduced and their programming seemed less sophisticated than before. The guards had been reinforced with additional personnel, but these new arrivals appeared to be standard security forces rather than the specialized riot suppression troops who had crushed our previous uprising. Evidence began accumulating that Warden Militant Korath was aware of our activities. Certain prisoners who had been involved in planning discussions were transferred to different work details without explanation. Others simply disappeared during shift changes, their workstations reassigned to new arrivals without any official acknowledgement of what had happened to the previous occupants. The Warden had clearly developed an intelligence network among the prisoner population, using informants to monitor potential threats to facility security. These collaborators were difficult to identify, as they maintained the same appearance of suffering and desperation as the genuine victims. The promise of better treatment or reduced sentences was apparently sufficient to purchase loyalty from certain individuals who had abandoned any hope of resistance. Korvac disappeared 3 days after completing his structural analysis of the facility's support systems. His workstation was cleaned and prepared for a new occupant before the next shift began, as if he had never existed. The speed and efficiency of his removal suggested that the surveillance network had been monitoring our activities far more closely than we had realized. Similar disappearances began occurring with increasing frequency, targeting prisoners who possessed specialized knowledge or leadership capabilities. Valdris was transferred to a different section of the facility, ostensibly for disciplinary reasons, but actually to isolate him from potential followers. Nix was reassigned to a work detail that required him to labor in areas where communication with other prisoners was impossible. The systematic dismantling of our resistance network demonstrated that Korath possessed detailed intelligence about our plans and personnel. The Warden was not simply reacting to obvious threats, but proactively neutralizing potential problems before they could develop into serious challenges to his authority. The man's counterintelligence capabilities rivaled those of any Imperial Guard command structure I had encountered during my military service. Despite these setbacks, the core group of conspirators continued developing plans for a final assault on the facility's infrastructure. The knowledge that our bodies would be processed into weapons after death provided motivation that transcended normal self-preservation instincts. We were fighting not just for freedom, but to prevent our remains from being used to kill other Imperial citizens in future conflicts. The rendering chambers had become the primary target for our planned sabotage operation. Destroying the chemical processing equipment would eliminate the facility's ability to extract useful materials from prisoner corpses, potentially making the entire operation economically unviable. The explosion would also serve as a signal for coordinated attacks on other critical systems throughout the facility. Access to the rendering chambers required navigating through maintenance tunnels that connected the upper and lower levels of the facility. These passages were monitored by motion sensors and automated security systems, but the equipment appeared to be designed for detecting large groups rather than individual infiltrators. A small team might be able to reach the target area without triggering the alarm systems. The chemical storage areas adjacent to the rendering chambers contain materials that could be combined to create powerful explosive devices. Industrial solvents, metal cleaning compounds, and organic processing chemicals could be mixed in specific proportions to produce devastating results. The confined space of the underground chambers would amplify the destructive effects of any explosion. My restraints would prevent me from participating directly in the sabotage mission, but I could provide tactical guidance and coordinate supporting activities among the prisoners who remained at their workstations. The assault would require precise timing to maximize its effectiveness while minimizing the risk of premature discovery by the facility's security forces. The remaining conspirators began preparing for what we all recognized would likely be a suicide mission. The facility's defenses had been strengthened significantly since the riot, and the chances of surviving a direct assault on critical infrastructure were minimal. However, the alternative was to continue laboring until death, knowing that our bodies would then be processed into materials for Imperial weapons. The irony of our situation was not lost on any of us. We had all been convicted of crimes against the Imperium, yet we were now planning to sacrifice our lives to prevent our remains from being used in service to the same system that had condemned us. The moral complexity of fighting against an empire we had once served added another layer of desperation to our already hopeless circumstances. The final phase of our plan commenced 3 days after Valdris's transfer to the isolation wing. Without his tactical expertise, leadership of the operation fell to me despite my physical limitations. The irony was not lost. A coward who had abandoned his post on Xerion Prime now found himself coordinating what would likely be the final act of defiance by the facility's remaining prisoners. My restraints made direct participation impossible, but I could still provide guidance to those with the mobility to carry out the actual assault. Korvac's replacement was a former munitions specialist named Hadrick, who possessed intimate knowledge of explosive compounds. The man had served with the Mordian Iron Guard before his court-martial for black market weapons dealing. His expertise with Imperial Ordnance made him invaluable for converting industrial chemicals into improvised demolition charges. During our carefully orchestrated meetings in the waste disposal areas, Hadrick outlined the specific combinations of materials that would produce maximum destructive effect in the confined spaces of the rendering chambers. The timing had to be perfect. The night shift change occurred at 200 hours facility time, creating a brief window when guard coverage was reduced and prisoner movement between sections was less closely monitored. The skeleton crew responsible for overnight security focused primarily on preventing escapes rather than monitoring internal movement, particularly in areas like the maintenance tunnels that were considered too dangerous for prisoners to access voluntarily. My reconnaissance missions had revealed that the rendering chambers operated continuously, with automated systems maintaining the chemical baths and conveyor mechanisms throughout the night cycle. The reduced human supervision during these hours would work to our advantage, as the explosion would have time to spread throughout the lower levels before emergency response teams could organize effective countermeasures. The facility's fire suppression systems were designed for standard industrial accidents, not deliberate sabotage using chemical accelerants. 3 prisoners had volunteered for the assault team despite understanding that survival was virtually impossible. Hadrick would handle the explosive devices, while a former Catachon jungle fighter named Grimm would provide security during the infiltration. The third member was Yates, a hive ganger whose small stature allowed him to navigate the narrowest sections of the ventilation system. Each man understood that they were essentially signing their own death warrants, but the alternative of continued exploitation had become intolerable. The weapons for our diversionary assault came from the facility's own production lines. Over the past weeks, certain prisoners had been deliberately introducing flaws into their assigned components, creating rejects that were supposed to be recycled, but could instead be salvaged for our purposes. Bayonet blanks that had been improperly tempered could be sharpened into crude knives. Power pack casings with dimensional errors could be filled with improvised incendiary compounds. The Imperial War Machine's own products would be turned against the system that created them. The communications center represented our secondary objective. Located on the facility's upper level, this installation coordinated with orbital supply ships and maintained contact with other Imperial installations throughout the sector. Destroying the communications array would prevent requests for immediate reinforcement, while also eliminating the facility's ability to warn other installations about our methods. The equipment was heavily shielded against electromagnetic interference, but physical destruction would still render it inoperable. My position at the workstation provided an ideal vantage point for coordinating the timing of multiple simultaneous attacks. The restraints that had been intended to prevent resistance actually served as camouflage, making it appear that I was simply another broken prisoner focused on his assigned labor. The guards had grown accustomed to my presence and no longer paid close attention to my activities, assuming that the bolts through my flesh had eliminated any threat I might pose. The servo skulls continued their patrol patterns, but their programming had not been updated to account for the possibility of coordinated resistance. These mechanical observers were designed to detect individual infractions rather than complex multi-stage operations. By timing our activities to coincide with gaps in their surveillance coverage, we could move personnel and materials without triggering automatic alerts to the security forces. The night of the assault arrived with the usual oppressive heat and industrial noise that characterized every hour in this hellish place. The temperature had actually increased over the past week as more cooling systems failed, creating conditions that pushed human endurance beyond reasonable limits. Several prisoners had collapsed during the day's shift, their bodies dragged away by servitors while the rest of us continued hammering heated metal into instruments of death. At precisely 200 hours, Hadrick began his approach to the maintenance access point that would provide entry to the lower levels. The man moved with the careful precision of someone who understood that a single mistake would doom not only himself, but the entire operation. His improvised explosive devices were concealed in a tool kit that appeared to contain standard maintenance equipment, the chemical components disguised as cleaning supplies and lubricants. Grimm followed 30 seconds later, his jungle warfare training evident in how he navigated the facility's obstacles without creating any sound that might alert the guards. The catachon carried a collection of sharpened metal fragments that could serve as throwing weapons if the assault team encountered unexpected resistance. His role was to eliminate any threats that might interfere with Hadrick's placement of the explosive charges. Yates disappeared into the ventilation system with the fluid grace of someone who had spent years moving through the confined spaces of Hive City infrastructure. His mission was to access the communications center from above, using maintenance shafts that bypassed the facility's normal security checkpoints. The ganger carried incendiary devices designed to destroy the delicate electronic equipment that maintained contact with the outside world. The diversionary attacks began 15 minutes after the assault team's departure. Prisoners throughout the facility started small fires using materials they had been hoarding for weeks. These blazes were not intended to cause significant damage, but rather to overwhelm the security forces with multiple simultaneous incidents requiring immediate attention. Guards rushed from one emergency to another, their response times degraded by the sheer number of problems demanding resolution. I watched from my workstation as chaos spread throughout the upper levels. The fires created thick smoke that interfered with servo skull operations while also providing concealment for prisoners moving between their assigned positions. Several guards had removed their helmets to improve visibility, making them vulnerable to attacks by prisoners armed with improvised weapons salvaged from the production lines. The first explosion came from the communications center, as Yates successfully destroyed the primary transmission equipment. The blast shattered windows throughout the upper level and sent debris cascading down onto the manufactorum floor. Emergency lighting activated automatically, bathing everything in hellish red illumination that made the facility look even more like the industrial hell it had always been. Guard response was swift but confused. The multiple diversionary fires had scattered the security forces across the facility, preventing them from concentrating their strength at any single location. Individual guards found themselves isolated and outnumbered by prisoners who had abandoned their workstations to join the general uprising. Shock malls crackled with electrical energy, but their limited range made them ineffective against coordinated attacks by multiple opponents. The main explosion came 23 minutes after the operation began. Hadrick had successfully reached the chemical storage areas adjacent to the rendering chambers and detonated his improvised devices with devastating effect. The blast was powerful enough to shake the entire facility, causing structural damage that extended far beyond the immediate target area. Pipes ruptured throughout the lower levels, releasing pressurized steam and toxic chemicals that would make the underground areas uninhabitable for hours. The rendering chambers themselves were completely destroyed. The massive chemical vats that had processed countless prisoner corpses were shattered beyond repair, their contents mixing with structural debris to create a toxic soup that would require extensive cleanup efforts. The conveyor systems that had fed human remains into the processing equipment were twisted into unrecognizable metal sculptures by the force of the explosion. Secondary explosions followed as ruptured chemical lines ignited, creating a chain reaction that spread throughout the facility's lower levels. The carefully maintained processing systems that had converted human bodies into useful materials were reduced to smoking wreckage. Years of investment in specialized equipment had been eliminated in a matter of minutes by prisoners using improvised weapons created from the facility's own resources. The structural damage was more extensive than I had anticipated. Support beams throughout the facility had been weakened by the blast, causing sections of the upper level to sag ominously as they struggled to bear loads they were no longer designed to support. Cracks appeared in the walls and ceiling, spreading like spider webs as the building's integrity continued to deteriorate. My restraints prevented me from joining the general uprising, but I could observe the chaos spreading throughout the manufactorum floor. Prisoners who had been broken by months of brutal treatment suddenly found reserves of strength they had not known they possessed. The knowledge that their bodies would no longer be processed into weapons after death had liberated them from the fear that had kept them compliant. The guards were fighting a losing battle against opponents who no longer cared about survival. Shock mauls that had once been instruments of absolute control became merely another weapon to be seized and turned against their former wielders. Several enforcers had already fallen to prisoner attacks, their carapace armor providing insufficient protection against determined assaults by multiple opponents armed with industrial tools. The facility's automated systems were beginning to fail as damage from the explosions cascaded through interconnected networks. Servo skulls crashed into walls as their navigation systems malfunctioned. Conveyor belts ground to a halt as their control circuits shorted out. The carefully orchestrated industrial process that had consumed human lives with ruthless efficiency was grinding to a chaotic halt. I realized that my position at the workstation had become untenable as the structural damage continued to worsen. The bolts that secured me to the metal surface were beginning to shift as the floor itself sagged under the weight of damaged overhead supports. Cracks were spreading through the concrete around my restraints, suggesting that the entire section might collapse without warning. The main forge chamber had become the focal point of the continuing battle between prisoners and guards. This vast space contained the facility's primary plasma furnace, a massive installation that provided the extreme temperatures necessary for advanced metallurgy. The furnace represented both the heart of the facility's operations and a potential target that could cause catastrophic damage if properly sabotaged. Reaching the plasma furnace required crossing nearly 100 meters of open floor space while under fire from the remaining guards. The enforcers had established defensive positions around the installation, using industrial equipment as cover while they attempted to prevent prisoner access to the critical systems. Their shock mauls had been supplemented with lasgun fire, creating a deadly crossfire that had already claimed dozens of rebel lives. The decision to attempt the final assault was not rational, but rather driven by the desperate knowledge that failure would result in a return to the previous conditions of exploitation and suffering. The rendering chambers had been destroyed, but the facility could still function as a standard labor camp if the primary production systems remained intact. Only by eliminating the plasma furnace could we ensure that this place would never again serve the Imperial War Machine. My restraints finally gave way as the floor section collapsed partially, the concrete cracking around the bolt points with sounds like gunshots. The pain of extraction was excruciating as the metal shafts tore through infected flesh and bone, but the sudden freedom was intoxicating after months of immobilization. Blood poured from the wounds where the bolts had been embedded, but adrenaline masked the worst of the agony. The approach to the plasma furnace was a nightmare of lasgun fire and electrical discharge from shock mauls. Bodies littered the floor between workstations, prisoners and guards alike fallen in the desperate struggle for control of the facility's heart. The air was thick with smoke from burning equipment and the metallic smell of spilled blood. Every step forward required navigating around corpses and debris while avoiding the concentrated fire of the remaining enforcers. A former Vestroian trooper named Kellick had reached the furnace controls ahead of me, his knowledge of industrial systems allowing him to begin the shutdown procedures that would destabilize the plasma containment fields. The man was wounded in multiple places, blood streaming from lasgun burns across his chest and arms, but he continued working with the focused determination of someone who understood the critical importance of his task. The guards realized what was happening and concentrated their fire on Kellick's position. Lasgun beams struck the control panel around him, sending showers of sparks cascading across the metalwork. The Vestroian absorbed multiple hits, but managed to complete the final sequence that would cause catastrophic failure of the containment systems. His body slumped over the controls as the plasma furnace began its death spiral. The containment failure progressed exactly as Kellek had intended. Superheated plasma began escaping from the primary chamber, its temperature sufficient to melt through the reinforced barriers that were supposed to direct its energy safely. Warning klaxons blared throughout the facility as automated systems detected the growing instability, but the damage was already beyond any possibility of correction. I reached the furnace chamber just as the first major containment breach occurred. A stream of molten plasma erupted from the primary housing, spraying across the ceiling and walls with the intensity of a miniature star. The heat was beyond anything I had experienced even in this hellish place, the air itself seeming to catch fire as the escaped plasma ionized atmospheric gases. The structural supports that held the chamber in place were beginning to fail under the extreme thermal stress. Metal beams that had been designed to last centuries were sagging and buckling as temperatures rose beyond their tolerance limits. The entire installation was beginning to collapse inward as its own weight overcame the weakened support framework. More containment breaches followed in rapid succession. The plasma furnace had been designed with multiple redundant safety systems, but the deliberate sabotage had created cascading failures that overwhelmed every protective measure. Molten metal began pouring from ruptured conduits, creating rivers of liquid fire that spread across the manufactorum floor. The remaining guards abandoned their positions as the chamber became uninhabitable. Even their protective equipment was insufficient against the radiant heat being generated by the failing containment systems. Several enforcers were caught by streams of molten plasma, their carapace armor providing no protection against temperatures that could vaporize steel instantly. I found myself trapped in the chamber as the collapse accelerated beyond all prediction. The exit routes had been blocked by fallen debris and streams of molten metal that made passage impossible. The air was becoming unbreathable as superheated gases displaced the normal atmosphere, each breath searing my lungs with temperatures that should have been instantly fatal. The ceiling began to give way as support beams failed throughout the structure. Massive chunks of reinforced concrete crashed down around me, their impacts sending shockwaves through the buckling floor. The sound was deafening, a continuous roar of destruction that drowned out even the facility's emergency alarms. A section of the overhead crane system broke loose and plummeted toward my position. The massive steel framework struck the floor with enough force to create a crater in the concrete, missing me by mere meters. The impact sent fragments of metal and stone flying in all directions, several pieces striking my body with enough force to break bones. The final containment breach occurred directly above my position. The primary plasma chamber ruptured completely, releasing its entire contents in a directed stream that carved through the facility's structure like a blade of pure energy. The molten plasma struck the overhead supports with devastating effect, severing the beams that held the entire upper level in place. The collapse was total and instantaneous. Hundreds of tons of concrete, steel, and industrial equipment crashed down into the chamber, driven by gravity and the structural failure of the entire facility. The sound was beyond description, a cacophony of destruction that seemed to shake the very foundations of the world. I was caught beneath the falling debris before I could even attempt to escape. A massive concrete beam struck my legs, crushing them instantly and pinning me to the floor. More wreckage piled on top, each impact driving me deeper into the growing mound of destruction. The weight was incredible, pressing down with enough force to crack ribs and compress my chest until breathing became nearly impossible. The pain was overwhelming but strangely distant, as if my nervous system had simply given up trying to process the extent of the damage. I could feel my body being crushed by the continuing avalanche of debris, but the sensations seemed to belong to someone else. Blood filled my mouth as internal injuries progressed beyond any hope of survival. Through the chaos of the collapse, I could hear the facility's emergency systems continuing to sound their warnings. New prisoners were already being transported to the facility from orbital ships, their arrival scheduled according to production quotas that took no account of the current destruction. The Imperial War Machine would continue grinding forward regardless of this temporary setback. The rendering chambers had been destroyed, but similar facilities existed throughout the Imperium. The weapons production would be relocated to other installations, where new prisoners would take up the hammers and anvils that we had abandoned. The cycle would continue unbroken, feeding the Emperor's armies with materials extracted from human suffering and death. My vision was fading as blood loss and crushing injuries took their inevitable toll. The weight of the debris continued to increase as more sections of the facility collapsed into the chamber. Each breath was a struggle against the pressure that compressed my chest, but I no longer had the strength to fight against the inevitable. The knowledge that our sacrifice had been meaningless was more crushing than the physical weight of the wreckage. We had destroyed one facility among thousands, eliminated one source of suffering among countless others. The Imperial War Machine would adapt and continue, finding new ways to extract value from human misery. The Imperium's appetite for resources was infinite, and there would always be more prisoners to feed its hunger. The darkness was closing in as my body finally surrendered to the massive trauma. The last thing I heard was the sound of transport ships landing outside the ruined facility, their cargo holds filled with fresh prisoners who would soon learn the same lessons of despair that had driven us to this futile rebellion. The cycle was indeed unbroken, and the Emperor's war machine would grind forward over our bones as it had over countless others before us. In my final moments, I understood that we had never been anything more than raw materials in the vast industrial process that sustained the Imperium. Our lives, our deaths, our very rebellion had been factored into the calculations of men who viewed human existence as simply another resource to be exploited. The facility would be rebuilt, the production quotas would be maintained, and new prisoners would take our places at the anvils where we had hammered out our own destruction.